This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we'll explore all you need to know about atrial fibrillation and its relationship to stroke. Plus, we'll learn about the process of getting on a list for a kidney transplant and the challenges that folks can face. But first, how a new device promises to help solve a life-threatening medical condition. Medical research is constantly providing healthcare providers with new and improved ways to treat patients. And here with us is one such researcher with some news about a new medical device that will do just that. Dr. Gary Niemann is an associate professor of surgery and a senior research scientist and the director of the Cardiopulmonary and Critical Care Lab at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Niemann. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Linda.
So you've just been awarded some money to pursue your research and to develop a particular device. Help us understand that. Tell us about it.
Well, the award was called the TAF Award, and it's a Technology Accelerator Fund. It's a newly instituted grant from the SUNY Research Foundation, and the goal is to utilize the intellectual property of the faculty in the SUNY system and to facilitate them from taking their ideas from the laboratory to the clinical market. So hence the term, Technology Accelerator Fund.
So they basically put some money behind people like yourself who are constantly coming up with new ideas to develop devices and various other ways.
Yeah, specifically either devices or pharmaceuticals that you can take to market.
That's
the key.
That's very encouraging. I don't think many people, our general population understands that SUNY is doing this kind of support.
It's really a fairly new concept. I think they just started a year or two ago.
And how much money were you given?
$60,000.
Wow. Well, so what is this device and why is it needed?
The device is named MIST, which stands for Minimally Invasive Suction and Treatment Device. And in our research, we found that in severely injured patients, in our case animal models, they developed what's called multiple organ dysfunction syndrome, or MODS. And one of the key pathologic components of MODS is what they call the abdominal compartment syndrome. And this is when, due to serious trauma or sepsis, blood infections, the intestines begin to swell, and they leak what is called ascites. And this ascites that leaks out of the intestine into the peritoneal cavity is very pro-inflammatory.
Which means it increases the inflammation?
Yes.
I'm going to step you back
sure.
a bit so that maybe our general listening audience can understand a little bit better. When you say severely injured patients, what are the kinds of patients who might develop this problem?
These would be your patients in the intensive care unit. In particular, sepsis, which is a blood infection, also the number one killer in the intensive care unit.
And that comes from infection secondary to things like pneumonia?
Pneumonia would be a direct lung infection. You could have...
How about a heart attack?
Probably not heart attack because there's not a bacterial or viral component.
So when there's an infection...
Infection or trauma, I think, is the two things.
That's
people
clear.
People in severe car accident... They would have dirty wounds. They may get infected.
And the infectious process then helps create this.
It's
circumstance where the body is creating more fluid in response
initially,
to the inflammation.
Right. In response, yes. Actually, the inflammation itself is the problem. We essentially evolved without intensive care units. So our immune system is extremely powerful. And once it's stimulated to a certain degree, such as a major car accident, trauma, or the bacteria actually gets in your blood, the inflammatory system goes all out. And actually, the problem that we have as clinicians trying to treat these syndromes is that we're trying to reduce the inflammation that's necessary to save your life.
So you're walking a fine line.
It's a teeter-totter. And so what we have to try to do is cool down the inflammation, but we can't shut it off or the bacteria will win. And the MIST device is an attempt to cool off the inflammation in the peritoneal cavity.
Which is around the stomach, the intestines.
Stomach and intestines, yes.
So what, first of all, what does, if left untreated, what does this inflammation and fluid do?
Sort of two components. The general component, it would act like a inflammatory oven, and all as the blood pumps through the stomach and the intestine, it would go through this sea of inflammation, and the blood would start to become inflamed and essentially carry it throughout the body. So it could cause secondary injury to the lung, to the kidney, to the liver. Specifically to the peritoneal cavity, it can cause something called the abdominal compartment syndrome. This is when the inflammation in the peritoneal cavity becomes so severe that the intestines swell and this fluid that leaks out, termed ascites, which is very inflammatory, starts to put pressure in the peritoneal cavity. So much so that it pushes on the lungs so that the patient can't breathe, and it pushes on the renal arteries so that there's no blood flow into the kidney.
So actually, mechanically, it's creating a problem.
Right.
So tell us about your MIST device. What does it do, and what does it look like?
We developed, I'll just go back a second.
Sure.
We developed it studying, looking at ways to essentially treat this abdominal compartment syndrome. But that's an end-stage disease. Essentially, the only treatment for it right now is very drastic. Essentially, the surgeon has to open up the patient's abdominal cavity and let the intestines actually come free of the body. So obviously, a very big downside. If they don't do that, it's 100% fatal. So there's no question they have to do it. So our thought while we were studying this is, why should we let the patient get that sick? Why don't we come up with an idea in order to try to cool off the inflammation in the peritoneal cavity before they develop this horrific disease with a very, very high mortality? So we came up with this device, this MIST device, which is just a series of catheters, suction catheters, essentially just tubes that you can use to remove fluid. Combined with essentially a sprinkler system, and it's inserted into the peritoneal cavity through minimally invasive laparoscopic surgery. As you know, that minimally invasive surgery is the really rage now. So through a 15 millimeter, about an inch hole in the patient's abdomen, the surgeon can place the device. They would then, using again minimally invasive techniques, place the suction catheters in their proper places to remove the inflammatory ascites, and the spray system, which would deliver a treatment fluid, which we call direct peritoneal resuscitation. It could be a combination of antibiotics and inflammatories, things to increase and improve the perfusion of the intestine.
So very direct therapy
very direct therapy. So
if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with medical researcher Dr. Gary Niemann. We're talking about his new minimally invasive infusion and suction therapy device, also called the MIST device, to basically save lives. So tell us a little bit about where you're at in this whole process.
With the TAF award, we are currently, with the money, we're going to do two things. We've already started with an engineering group who have drawn up the blueprints for the MIST device and are now producing it for us. Once they give us this initial prototype, we will test it for efficacy in our very sophisticated animal models of multiple organ dysfunction and abdominal compartment syndrome. Once we show efficacy, then we would move on to a real prototype. This is the prototype we're using now is a early prototype, and we're not going for the full prototype because of cost. So if we show proof of concept that this in fact will reduce inflammation, reduce organ injury, reduce mortality, then we hope we can obtain more funding in order to develop the full device and take it to the next level.
How are you, what are you projecting its effectiveness will be in the best scenario in terms of saving lives? I mean, what percentage?
I think the target population would be somewhat limited, but in patients at serious risk, I think it would have a tremendous benefit. I'm a basic scientist, so I don't treat patients, but we have some key opinion leaders that are the president of the World Organization for Abdominal Compartment Syndrome, and they are essentially dying for something to be able to treat their patients rather than just watch them progress to this horrific disease. So the clinicians I work with are very excited about the potential. It should be minimal downside because suction catheters are put in patients all the time. This is just sort of a sophisticated suction catheter with a drug delivery system. So it's not too much different from the standard of care for a patient that had, you know, abdominal problems.
But the hope is that you can allay or prevent the progression of this disease till it becomes basically fatal.
Right. Our lab's whole focus is on preventing these very serious syndromes rather than letting them develop and then try to treat them, because treatment of any of the syndromes associated with multiple organ dysfunction has a very high mortality.
What do you project the timeline will be to from an idea like this to fruition? Generally, what does that take?
I have several patents, several ideas. None of them thus far have come to market. So I don't have a personal knowledge of what it takes from idea to market. I do know we're working with an entrepreneur out of Buffalo, and he's taken a device called SmartPill from idea to market. And to take a medical device from idea to market is a much shorter period of time than a pharmaceutical, which could have all kinds of biological functions that you have to test and make sure that...
A lot of clinical trials and things of that nature.
We have to go through the same clinical trials, but our device is pretty simple compared to a sophisticated pharmacologic. So it should be much quicker. So we're saying 5 years rather than 10 or 15 years, just a guess. Also, it's a very expensive proposition. The entrepreneur that we're working with estimates it'll take $20 million to get the product to market. A lot of this will be with venture capital. And again, we need to show very convincing preclinical evidence in our laboratory that indeed this will work in order to get the investors.
Well, I hope you get all the support you need. It sounds like a very important device and something that can really make a difference and save lives, especially
surely hope so.
In these kinds of situations. In the little bit of time we have left, I know you have been working on 5 other patents you've alluded to. Give us just a smattering of ideas of what the kinds of things you have begun to work on.
We are also looking at pharmacologic prevention of multiple organ dysfunction and abdominal compartment syndrome. So several drugs are on the patent list, all which we're still working on. A device to identify lung injury preemptively. And what we're really excited about now is we actually are using standard ventilators with alterations in the mechanical ventilation profile, and we're demonstrating that we can actually prevent the organ damage to the lung just with preemptive mechanical ventilation.
That's fascinating. So you really have been focusing on this multiple organ
and prevention
syndrome.
Rather than treatment.
Prevention rather than treatment. Very sound, and it's exciting to think that someone of your creative mind is kind of devoting yourself to this kind of problem and coming up with a lot of different possible solutions.
Well, thank you. It's actually very exciting.
It is, and I applaud
enjoy
you.
Coming to work every morning.
I applaud you for the work. My guest has been Dr. Gary Niemann, Associate Professor of Surgery, Senior Research Scientist, and the Director of the Cardiopulmonary and Critical Care Lab at Upstate Medical University. Thanks again for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Coming up next, all you need to know about atrial fibrillation. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. While many of us have felt our heart flutter at times and even skip a beat, but a consistent, irregular heartbeat is of greater concern. And here to tell us more about this is Dr. Luna Bhatta. She's Associate Professor of Medicine, specializing in cardiology and electrophysiology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Bhatta. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So a consistent, irregular heartbeat can be worrisome. Why is that?
The consistent, irregular heartbeat is mostly atrial fibrillation, which is the most common arrhythmia that we see nowadays. Predominantly, the patients suffering from atrial fibrillations are 65 years and above, but my youngest patient was 22 years old.
So there is a range there.
Range.
Please. What exactly, when we say atrial fibrillation or arrhythmia, what's happening?
Your heart is basically a muscle pump, has valve and vessel, and they can all be normal, but it's driven by electricity. So if your electricity becomes a problem, that's when we call it arrhythmia or dysrhythmia, and atrial fibrillation is one of the most common dysrhythmia.
So in other words, there's a problem in the electricity within our body, not outside electricity.
But within our body, in the heart. There is a certain hierarchy of activation of the electricity in the heart. It has to go from one place to another regularly, but if so many places in your upper chamber of the heart start firing, your heart rate can go up to 300 to 600 beats per minute on the upper chamber that cause chaotic pumping of the heart. That's why.
So basically they pump out of rhythm,
which
is arrhythmia,
yeah.
And they cause the problems with the function of the heart.
With the function.
So it's pumping too fast, or sometimes is it too slow?
It's inefficient pumping. It feels like one doctor gave a good example. He said it's like a six-cylinder car running on four-cylinder. Can you run? Yes. Are you efficient? No. Can you go for too long? No.
So it can really present a problem. So why is it dangerous?
The atrial fibrillation itself is not a potentially lethal arrhythmia, but the comorbidities associated with it, like stroke, there's 5 times higher risk of stroke on people with atrial fibrillation without blood thinner than people with atrial fibrillation.
Why is that? What is the mechanism with the irregular heartbeat that leads to a stroke?
Because the heart, the 2 chambers of the heart out of the 4 chambers are quivering at the rate of 300. Our normal heart, regular heart, should run from 60 to sometimes go up to 160.
But so it's very, very, very fast.
Right. It's quivering. There's a static blood flow that causes clot that if it gets loose, gets sent to the brain, and you have a brain, just like heart attack, you have a brain attack, we call them stroke.
So in fact, what you're saying is you basically are more likely to form clots.
Yes.
Which can then go to the brain to cause the
stroke. Dislodge from the heart and taken by the artery to your brain.
So how common is this?
It's a very common problem. In the United States alone, there is 2.6 million people with the problem, and every year, 150,000 to 160,000 new diagnoses. Worldwide, it's 6 million people. It's
wow.
An epidemic.
Wow. Do they know why it seems like the numbers are increasing?
There are a lot of research going on about this arrhythmia. The main reason why we have it is not very clear. But there are several hypotheses and theory based on which we have treatment for it.
So they don't really exactly know.
Exactly. The mechanism is not very agreed upon or established.
But one thing is clear when you say, you mentioned earlier, when you say who is at risk, you said most people are over 65.
Yes.
So age must play some role here.
Some of the theory is your heart beats since the time you're born till you get old and you get wear and tear. You know, you're replaced by fibrous tissues. But we see that in young people, that theory does not explain that.
So it can exist. As you mentioned, you had a patient as young as
22
in their 20s.
Years.
Yeah. So it isn't. Oh, it's not the full explanation.
No.
So besides the age as being a factor, what other factors might contribute to your being at risk for developing this arrhythmia?
Atrial fibrillation.
Yeah.
People with diabetes, high blood pressure, now we are finding out there is an entity called obstructive sleep apnea. We always screen patients when we see atrial fibrillation if they have this, and they're more easy to treat if we treat those problems.
So they will often have these underlying problems, as you mentioned, comorbidities, things that exist alongside the atrial fibrillation, which are seen as possibly the cause or maybe just...
It's associated with AFib, but not necessarily the cause.
I read somewhere also that something like, for some people, drinking alcohol can actually trigger an episode of
atrial... That's a very interesting point you brought up. There is actually a name called holiday heart. So people have binge drinking. A lot of time it's young college student, and they end up like Sunday morning in the ER with rapid heartbeat, turn out to be atrial fibrillation. So there is association with alcohol. We tell our patients at least to cut down or not drink excessively because it can trigger this arrhythmia.
Does it run in families?
Very good question. There are some family, they have identified some genes, but it's not always the case.
So it's not a clear
hereditary entity. Yes.
So what actually causes it? Is it an abnormality in the heart structure that causes it? Or you said this, the wear and tear.
Yes. So usually when we get old, a lot of time the normal tissues are replaced by fibrous tissues, and they don't get the normal tissue do not get as quickly regenerated. And that's one of the reasons the fibrous tissue can become a source or pathway of the arrhythmia.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with cardiologist and electrophysiologist Dr. Luna Bhatta, and we're talking about atrial fibrillation, a serious arrhythmia. So how do you know if you have it?
The symptoms are across the board. Some patients told me that they feel like fish plopping in their heart. Some feel like there's thunder rumbling. Some feels like just out of sync. There's something not right with them. But some can be so subtle. One of my patients was just unusually tired. His wife noticed that he's taking frequent nap. So when he was brought in, I found him to be in atrial fibrillation. So it's not quite consistent.
And how about things like lightheadedness or confusion or shortness of breath? Did you ever get chest pain?
Yes, those all can happen with people with atrial fibrillation, especially if their heart rate are very fast.
You know, it's interesting because I read somewhere that some people have no symptoms. So then how would you know?
You brought up a very interesting point because, unfortunately, the first presentation on some patients is stroke, because they never felt it. So we have still not figured out how to screen those patients, but when you get to a certain age, your doctor will do an EKG on your visit.
You're talking about your primary care.
Primary care doctor, and that's from EKG, the diagnosis can be made very quickly.
But that's if it's a consistent pattern. Aren't there some types of atrial fibrillation that come and go?
Exactly. There's one form called paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. They correct themselves, so they complain about it, but we cannot see it in the EKG because when they come to see us, they're normal. So we can just arrange a long-term monitoring.
Is that the Holter monitor?
Holter can be 24 to 48 hours. Now we can monitor patients for almost a month.
Oh, really?
In some patients, we can even implant a very small metal piece underneath their skin that can track the rhythm for us for up to 2 to 3 years now.
Oh, my goodness. That must be very new.
Very new, yes.
And that obviously would help you make a conclusive diagnosis.
Yes, yes. We periodically check the device and see if they have episodes that those were asymptomatic.
What are the kinds of things that you recommend to patients either once they've had the problem or what are the treatment protocols at this point for atrial fibrillation?
Basically, we want to protect. The first important thing is to protect patients from stroke. So if you have certain risk factors, like women are more prone to stroke with atrial fibrillation than men. So you want to talk about blood thinner with your doctor.
Why does the blood thinner, let me say it for you, when you said that the heart would create more potential for clots, the blood thinner prevents that from happening?
Or it prevents it from dislodging and going into the brain. We call it help laminate the thrombus so it stays where in the wall, or it prevents from formation. So those blood thinner, they're very, very potent. They can cut down 2/3 of the risk of stroke. So it's very important to discuss that with your doctor. And there are other several ways to treat it. You can either control the rate or use medication to get you back to normal rhythm. So you can discuss with your doctor, depending on your situation, what is the best treatment. But the most important thing I cannot emphasize enough is to protect you from stroke.
And because that can be, you actually have very effective treatments for
that. Yes, we have effective treatment.
Is there also a problem with heart failure that follows from atrial fibrillation? Does it do damage to the heart over time?
Yes, because your heart is beating faster and more irregular, so your heart will not sustain like that for too long without getting into trouble. So they develop heart failure. That's how they present, and we realize they were having AFib for a long time and they just didn't know it.
So it sounds to me, especially when you say they just didn't know it and the potential complications from it can be so significant,
yes,
that it's really important to have some check, especially as you age and you achieve that age of 65, to make sure that on a routine basis you should be checking to
exactly.
see.
Exactly, and you can pay attention to your symptoms. If you're unusually tired for too long, that could be a sign that your heart is irregular, but just be vigilant about it.
So treatment is available, is what you're saying.
Yes.
So it's not like, and the atrial fibrillation alone is not going to be life-threatening.
No.
It's the complications over time.
The stroke with atrial fibrillation is potentially lethal and very debilitating compared to other strokes.
So if you were to just give advice to someone, what would you say to someone that have any of these symptoms, when would you say go to see a doctor?
It's never too early. If you have feeling that your heart is not beating right or you feel palpitation, call them right away and have you get seen. The doctor should be happy to diagnose you early than wait for too long and then
and end up with a much more serious complication.
Yes, I would recommend not to wait.
Well, I want to thank you so much. This is very helpful and very important information. I don't think many people really understand the significance of atrial fibrillation. As you said, maybe with the aging of the population on a global scale, we're seeing more of it.
Exactly. So we're doing a lot of work. The Heart Rhythm Society has a campaign. They put up an awareness picture in the Times Square just to make people aware. That's our job. And the more people know it, the better we can do treating them.
And preventing real
them.
Problems. Well, thank you so very much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Luna Bhatta. She's Associate Professor of Medicine, specializing in cardiology and electrophysiology at Upstate Medical University. Once again, pleasure to have you. Thanks
thank you very much. I enjoyed myself.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up, better brainstorming in a few easy steps, or let's get creative. Well, folks, you know that mind bender problem that's been giving you a headache for too long? In the next couple of minutes, I'm going to tell you a powerful, research-supported way to come up with more and more creative ideas to solve it and any other problem that comes up going forward in your life. And get this, you already know how to do it. You just have to put step one, being what you already know how to do, together with step two, brainstorming. And it's free. And it's la-di-da-di-da-di-da, easy. Want to guess which everyday behavior it is? Hint, Einstein enjoyed doing it. And the research showed it made no difference doing it facing a wall or doing it in one room with brainstorming after in another room or doing it inside or outside. This is getting interesting, isn't it? Give up? Walking. Not even brisk walking or power walking or race walking. Just plain old la-di-da-di-da-di-da strolling along led to bing, 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 bingo. on creativity tests like coming up with novel uses for common everyday objects, people walking were more creative than when sitting. Like, for example, asked for novel uses for a button, someone stepping out said, a doorknob for a dollhouse. Don't you just love that one, a doorknob for a dollhouse? And this mind-expanding effect of walking was very powerful. In four separate studies, people walking were more creative from 81 to 100% of the time. And it didn't matter strolling on a treadmill while gazing at a blank wall or outside with the birdies and the trees in the sky and other strolling Einsteins. And people were just as creative sitting down right after walking as they were while meandering along. So, next time me, you, or you and your partner in parenting, or you and your business team, or whatever, are stumped, let's follow in Einstein's footsteps and get creative. I'm Dr. Rich, the Perambulator O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Up next, how do you get on a kidney transplant list? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen. Here's our Healthy Monday Minute for this week. Get fit by walking. The minimum 30 minutes of exercise required daily for a healthy lifestyle doesn't necessarily entail a vigorous workout session at a state-of-the-art facility. Walking is a simple exercise that is proven to be effective in weight loss. Additional to weight loss, walking also helps to lower cholesterol, reduces the risk of type 2 diabetes, increases bone strength, and improves circulation. If you've been sedentary, start walking 3 times a week at a stroll for 20 minutes. Work your way up to 5 or 6 times a week, 30 minutes per session, for a total of 2.5 to 3 hours per week. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, nationwide, there are over 100,000 people on waiting lists for organ donations. And kidneys are among the organs with the greatest demand and the greatest transplant success. Well, here to tell us more about the process of evaluation and waitlisting for a kidney transplant is Lavelle Jones, a registered nurse and the pre-transplant coordinator for Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Lavelle. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So nationwide, I guess kidneys are in very high demand. Tell us about that. I mean, why is there a shortage nationwide?
There's a shortage because of the lack of awareness of people to donate. Diabetes is growing on a whole. People are lacking the management of their diabetes, so then they're requiring dialysis to maintain their life. And if people don't know, you know, how to maintain their health, then that can cause the risk of kidney transplant being so great.
So in other words, because the diabetes is growing in our country, we know it's at epidemic proportions, more people go into kidney failure and may actually be in need of a transplant.
Yes, that's correct.
Whereas that's really changed. And has there been a concomitant increase in knowledge or awareness of the need for donation? Because it sounds to me like there are just not enough kidneys around.
Right. I think the need for donation could be increased by making people aware, like going out doing outreaches in churches and communities, you know, just to make the awareness greater for people.
How is the shortage affecting lives right now, though? Are people dying on wait lists?
Yes, people are dying on the waiting list due to long term of being on dialysis. It can weaken the heart and decrease the overall quality of life because transplant is ultimately the best goal for patients in need of who have end-stage renal disease.
And you've seen some really positive results with transplants.
Oh, yes, I have. I've been doing this over, you know, about 8 years now, and it's been really great, and it's very rewarding to see patients get a kidney transplant.
They do, their lives do change.
Oh, yes. People go back to work. We even have patients volunteer in the clinic to see our new recipients going through the process.
Well, that's wonderful. That's really a positive thing. So how is it that people can donate now? I mean, what are the types? I know that there's the living donation so that you find someone who's a match and they actually can give you one of their kidneys.
Right. So there's living donation where, you know, someone can come forward to donate to you. You don't have to stress yourself trying to figure out their blood type. We can do that part and check for compatibility. And even if they're an incompatible donor with you, maybe they'll agree to do a swap with another person who has a donor that's compatible with you. And also we have anonymous donors who come forward. They want to do a good deed and donate one of their kidneys. And if you happen to be a good match for them, there's a chance you could receive that kidney.
Wow. So there really are, that in terms of the living donors, there are options. And how about how you can donate a kidney prior to your death? How does that happen?
Some people do directed donation. If they know they're not going to do well and the family members know their wishes, they can agree to donate to somebody like a family member in need of a kidney transplant. We've had a few success stories as well with that. People have done direct donations.
So the idea here is that you can donate in a variety of ways, mm-hmm. in terms of the resources for kidneys. In your experience, are there more living donors giving kidneys? I mean, in what you've seen versus getting them from people who've died?
It's kind of equivalent right now with living and deceased donors. We do strongly encourage living donors. However, you know, if everybody signs the organ donation card or makes sure their families are aware of their wishes, then that increases the deceased donor transplants.
So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with pre-transplant coordinator Lavelle Jones. We're talking about the need for kidney donation, and we're going to start talking a little bit about the process because, Lavelle, that's where you come in.
Yeah.
So let's say you need a kidney. You're one of those people out there who discovers that they need it. They've been on dialysis. They really could benefit from a new kidney. What's the process? First of all, how do they end up in your program at Upstate, and then what happens after that?
So usually you're referred by your kidney doctor. The best time is before you even start dialysis. You don't have to wait till you're on dialysis to be in need of a kidney transplant. The earlier you start the process, the better. So if you are on dialysis, you know, you should get referred as soon as possible.
So the idea here is that if someone already knows they have advanced kidney disease such that they might need dialysis, then they really, really need to think in terms of the kidney transplant. So then what happens? They're referred to your program, and what takes place?
So once you're referred, we do an intake process where we screen it to look at your risk factors, because ultimately the goal with transplant is to improve your quality of life. So if you have cardiac problems and things, we want to make sure we have the cardiac clearance needed. So once you come to our program, you start off with an education session for about an hour. And then you're here for a 4-hour visit total, sometimes a little longer, depending on what other testing we might require. But at that time, you'll meet with the transplant surgeon or the transplant nephrologist, our nutritionist, our social worker, our financial coordinator, who will go over your estimated cost, how much the meds may cost you after transplant based on your current insurance. So it's very important to keep us updated about your insurance if it ever changes.
Is most of this kind of stuff covered by insurance these days?
A lot of it is, but some patients may have big out-of-pocket expenses. So we want to make sure that they can afford to take the meds, because in the event that they can't, they will lose the transplant.
So the meds have to do with the rejection and
yes.
maintaining the body so that it accepts the new kidney.
Yes.
So what's exactly the process of evaluating? In other words, what factors go in to determine who is a good candidate and how to find a match.
Okay. So we're looking at your cardiac status, your pulmonary status. If those are in good qualities, you know, you will continue through the process. But to find a match, we look at your blood typing, and we look at the potential donor's blood typing to make sure you're compatible. We also look at your antigens, which we do tissue typing through the tissue typing lab on your initial evaluation day as well.
So an antigen is the thing that would reject the kidney. So you...
Antigen is just checking for compatibility. So we look at six of them. They're genetic markers specific to you. So the more that match between you and a donor, the better chance of your body not rejecting the kidney. So if it's a 6 out of 6 match, that's a perfect match kidney. So the more that match there, the better. However, sometimes you don't have to match it antigens. Antibodies are the ones where your body may reject the kidney and try to fight it off. So we want to avoid antibodies.
Okay. So once again, how many people right now are on a waiting list in our region?
Currently, we have 276 patients approximately on the waiting list here at SUNY Upstate.
So how does, again, so you go, you come in, you have all of these evaluations done, they counsel you, they talk to you about the process, what to expect, all of that, and then what happens to you?
Then we take your information and we do a comprehensive review of you at our interdisciplinary team meeting to make sure you are a suitable candidate. So if everything adds up and you're found to be a suitable candidate, then you would receive a phone call from me telling you you're placed on the waiting list, and you'll get a letter informing you that you're placed on the waiting list.
How does the decision be made? How is the decision made where you fall on the waiting list? Is it only a matter of when you've come into the process, or are other factors, do other factors play a role?
That's a good question. A lot of patients think once they're on the waiting list, we can say what number you are. We never truly know what number you're on the waiting list until we actually have a kidney offer for you. Then we can tell you what number you are for that donor.
So do other things, for example, like age, gender, or comorbid, you know, other medical problems play a role in that decision in terms of whether you are going to be moved up on the list or moved down on the list, or even, if I may add, something like wealth. I know that there was a talk at one time that wealthier people were getting organs ahead of people perhaps who were less wealthy.
So, no, we don't base it on the amount of money you have or the wealth that you are.
That you have.
So what it means, it is a lot of factors that go in place. Your age, a lot of your diagnosis, they add up as points. So we have a system called UNET where we put all your information in. So the computer actually tells us how well you match that donor. So when an offer becomes available, those factors will play in, come into place. Excuse me, your age, because we want to match it closer to the recipient. We want to make sure you have a kidney that'll give you a long life, or if you're an older recipient, they'll try to match it to you where you at least get good life out of that kidney.
So that's where age plays a role. In other words, it doesn't play a role necessarily that if you're older, you won't be a candidate. It's saying that if you're older, we'll be looking for a kidney that's somewhat age matched to you.
Right. So
possible.
We want to find something age appropriate for you. So that way, you know, it'll be a closer match based on your current age.
Currently, you say there's 276 people waiting. What's an average wait time?
Average waiting time is about 4 years unless you have a living donor.
And if you have a living donor, that means you have brought someone that you know who's stepped forward to say, I'd like to try to donate.
Right, or sometimes your family members may contact us without you even knowing to go through the process. So it can take 6 to 12 weeks for a donor process, depending on where that donor falls. If they work out as a donor, you could possibly get a transplant within about 2 months. But we want to make sure you as the recipient are ready medically for a transplant.
So both sides have to be fully evaluated.
Yes.
And then determined if it's a match. Is it harder these days to find matches, or is it easier with the technology that we have?
I think it's easier with the technology to determine the suitable match for a recipient.
But it sounds to me like the problem still lies in the fact that not that many people come forward to offer. I mean, you know, or even are willing to donate after death. Because I read somewhere that there's a relatively new law called Loren's Law in New York State, where now anyone who's over 18 and goes to the DMV to get a new license has to answer the question, yes or no, if they would be willing to donate an organ. And that's a pretty new step in terms of trying to get the word out and get people aware, as you said before, that this is something they can do, and it doesn't have to be while they're alive.
Yes, that's true. And the more, you know, if everybody signs up, especially, you know, when you turn 18, we encourage you strongly to say yes or no to organ donation. Of course, we would love for you to say yes. And again, if everybody speaks to their family members and let them know that you need a transplant or even just to talk about organ donation in general.
Do people who are living and given a kidney generally do well after that type of surgery?
Oh, yes, they do very well. We've had donors go home within a day of donation. Usually the average time usually is, it used to be about 3 days, but I've seen people go home anywhere between 1 and 3 days. And donors do well, and they primarily just need pain medicine just for the discomfort that they have from the donation.
Wow. Well, obviously a very good cause. Obviously what you're doing is crucial for all of those 276 people and future people who are going to be on the wait list. So I want to thank you so much for all of your help and this very interesting information. My guest has been registered nurse Lavelle Jones. She's the pre-transplant coordinator for the Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks for helping us.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. How do we become empathetic? Is empathy something we learn when we are little? Can we ever really teach it? Many times it seems that only when we experience something do we then have the ability to understand when someone else is experiencing a similar trauma. Dr. Susan Wong, who's a fellow of ophthalmology, wrote us an essay about her experience with empathy. I would like to read an excerpt from it. It's called Prime of Life Redefined. In the summer of 2010, I was at the prime of my life. I graduated from medical school, got married to my longtime love, and started my medical internship on my way to becoming an ophthalmologist. I was young, carefree, and had been healthy all of my life. One sunny afternoon, driving home from work, my hand somehow brushed up against my neck, and I discovered a large, firm, non-tender lymph node. I had been asymptomatic otherwise. 2 months into my internship, I was unexpectedly diagnosed with stage 4 nasopharyngeal carcinoma. My whole life and plan that I had laid out before me were turned upside down. The ENT doc broke the news to me after my biopsy returned. My first response was tears. My second response, what about my internship? The 4 months of chemo radiation was immensely grueling. I was admitted to the hospital for neutropenic fever twice, was in and out of the ER during Christmas and New Year's. A feeding tube was placed due to my inability to swallow. My only means of communication with others was through hand gestures and typing on a keyboard. I became so sick, fatigued, and tired for months, all I could do was lie in bed with barely enough strength to stand. As my physical strength dwindled, my mental strength followed. From a physician's and patient's standpoint, there was no doubt about the importance of science with the type of chemo and dosage used and the exact mapping of the radiation to best obliterate the cancer. As a patient, though, I realized it was rather the humanities that played a larger role. We patients spend a few hours a day getting treatment, but we spend the remainder of the day and the night enduring side effects and sorting out emotions. I found comfort in the compassion of the nurses that I interacted with on a daily basis. I found strength in the support that I unexpectedly received from strangers, other cancer survivors who had become friends and mentors. In medical school, the main teaching points about diet and exercise were that they have an effect on diabetes and cardiac disease. As a patient, I realized that lifestyle played a role in more realms than just those two diseases. I became more mindful in de-stressing and eating more nutrient-dense food, which gave me a sense of control with my cancer. After my treatment ended, I had a slow recovery. It took another 5 months to return to my baseline in weight, strength, and energy level. By the time I fully recovered, it was time for me to restart my internship in July with a new class. Come wintertime, I had arrived at the halfway mark of completing internship. Aside from my short hairdo, subtle skin hyperpigmentation, and water bottle that I kept in my white coat at all times due to my dry mouth, no one could guess the taxing experience that I had undergone. As a physician, I can unreservedly empathize and provide patients with needed emotional strength. I am cognizant now of the human component of medicine. Being entrenched in academic institutions, we converse with other colleagues at times about rare zebra cases that we come across and how interesting they are. I now remember to be humble before what I see and realize how real the diseases are to the patients. I have come to realize, too, that it is impossible to ever return to my previous normal life, but rather adapt to my new normal now. The uncertainty of the future or possible recurrence could never fully vanish from the back of any cancer survivor's mind. Every day is relished. I have learned life is fleeting. With these notions, in addition to recommencing my career and being surrounded by loving family, I am once again at the prime of my life.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when, in honor of its opening, we explore Upstate's new state-of-the-art cancer center and the new services it will offer. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Sirio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.